So I have to admit, I've been uncomfortable giving. So just in case anybody here actually read my paper. So I put out a paper about 6 months ago that contains at least one error. So today I will correct that error, but I hope to have a lot more.
Recorded.
It's too late. It's all too late.
So I'll correct that error, but I hope to have a lot more quantitative predictions before I have to talk about it. I might schedule this talk too early. So I will tell you what I know. I think it's pretty interesting, but so keep your expectations low, I guess. So this talk is about the relative neutrino background. I want to know what is the self-interaction dynamics of the relative neutrino background. So I'm going to give an introduction and describe why I think this is important. The major points I'm going to cover is, first I'm going to describe that massive cosmological relics are actually quantum liquids. They're not isolated point particles flying around like billiard balls, which would be a possible guess. I'm going to describe the interaction of quantum liquids, particularly fermion quantum liquids. These had a collective mode known as zero sound. This was discovered by Landau back in the 50s. I'm going to describe the two kinds of collective excitations that occur in the neutrinos. There's a vector and then a tensor mode. Then I'm going to go on and talk about several considerations, like normalization, what is the cutoff of this theory, and what are the
Do you have a chemical potential in the neutrinos?
Yes. That's entirely the point.
They're going to be degenerate.
No, not degenerate. I mean, the neutrinos, well, using their regular parameters that you would expect, they have a chemical potential. It's not a degenerate system. The temperature is not small compared to the potential. So, where are we today? The universe is not actually empty. Everywhere in space, there's actually two different kinds of particles. We have neutrinos and we have photons. We, to leading order, are justified. Do you have a pointer, Kevin?
It's a hockey stick right over here.
Yeah.
And you can handle it.
So leading order, we're justified in neglecting these things simply because the temperatures, the number of densities, are smaller than our experiments and smaller than the mean scale. So the effects of these things are small. Our field theories and our experiments have actually told us what's going on at high energies. Particularly, we found the W and Z boson and possibly Higgs. And if I take a look at the scales that are known, I find that I can write interesting ratios of these scales that seem to look like the Planck scale. In particular, the Z mass squared over the temperature, or the Z mass squared over the Fermi momentum. The Fermi momentum is essentially the cube root of the density, and it's going to come up a lot. It's essentially the density. So first, let me briefly review what the cosmic neutrino background is doing today.
Do you mind just saying that the last point again? Is that
Fermi momentum?
No, the Planck scale. Is that the Dirac Life number problem? Or
I don't know. I'm simply saying if I write these ratios down, it's alarmingly close to the Planck scale, numerically. Could be a coincidence. I don't know.
Can you quantify that?
Quantify that? This is smaller than the Planck scale by about a factor of 1,000.
That's the observation that the electronable scale or the cosmological constant scale is the weak scale squared divided by the Planck scale.
Same one.
Running factor.
Yeah, same one. I'm running it backwards because I know these scales exist. And I know what they are. I know exactly microscopically what the theory is that generates these scales. You can use a cosmological constant and Planck's constant to do similar things, but I have no idea where those come from. So I want to see what part of physics can tell me. So cosmic neutrinos decouple from the Big Bang plasma at temperature around 2 MeV. At that time, they had a thermal Fermi-Dirac distribution. As the universe expands, their density and temperature redshift, and today they have a temperature that is simply related to the photon temperature by a ratio of the number of degrees of freedom, and it's approximately 2,000 today. They have a number density that is again related to the photon temperature by a ratio of the number of degrees of freedom, that is today 56 per cubic centimeter per particle antiparticle per species. So just looking at this, at least two species must be non-relativistic today. There are some arguments in the literature that if they cluster gravitationally, the density can be enhanced. Due to large mixing, the flavor composition is equilibrated. So all three mass eigenstates have approximately equal densities. In principle, there's an asymmetry. It's the number of neutrinos minus the number of antineutrinos relative to the photon density. And this is related to the baryon asymmetry. So this is approximately 10 to the minus 10 today. So leading order, one can neglect any asymmetry and assume that the number of neutrinos is equal to the number of antineutrinos. So the chemical potential is very nearly zero, but it is present and not discussed. So the question I want to ask is, well, we never consider these ratios of these scales, and why not? To my mind, this looks like a finite temperature, finite density theory with one small parameter, namely a Fermi momentum or a temperature at about 10 to minus 3 eV, and a large parameter, so 1 over the square root of G Fermi, at 10 to the 11 eV. And each ratio of these scales could, in principle, have new dynamics arising. Therefore, I'm led to ask the following question. What exactly is the standard model dynamics, which arises proportional to the Fermi momentum, Fermi momentum times G Fermi, square of that, or this one? I think we must answer this question, because at each one of these scales, there exist dynamics which we've measured that constitutes a very big problem for our current theories. So we should find out what the standard model is doing at these scales. Some of these are, you know, dark matter dynamics, the Kolmogorov constant, Pioneer anomaly, the Wand acceleration parameter, all can be expressed approximately in this way. And
Critical mass is bigger than really vacuum walls or less than vacuum walls.
Oh, we don't know. But
no, the estimate makes no matter.
So I have the two mass differences we measured are these. 10 to the minus 9 times 10 to the minus 3 and 5 times 10 to the minus 2 eV. So they're at the same, they're at this scale. The point that I'm making is that there is a collection of things at this low scale, and then there's this high scale as well. So which of these things could be related to which of these other things? I think it's a very reasonable assumption that one or more may be related to each other. But currently our theories don't relate them at all. They're all independent parameters. In particular, they're independent from the cosmological constant, they're independent from, there's these three anomalies, this is the acceleration I get from the cosmological constant, the Mond acceleration parameter, the Pioneer anomaly, are all sitting at this funny scale. And this I can express as the Fermi cubed times G Fermi. So if I had a finite temperature density theory, it would be natural for this ratio of scales to come out somehow. So it seems logical to try and look at this.
Why the first and the fourth? The Fermi momentum, the neutrinos, and the temperature, they're not the same thing?
They're not the same thing, but they're the same within a vector of two things.
Yeah.
I'm just using the Fermi momentum as a proxy for low energy scale. It could be temperature, it could be.
They're both the same order, mind you.
Both the same order, really.
It's really the same.
Yes.
The Mond scale. I think I would prefer to if you called it the Tully-Fisher scale, that it's a scale right off the Tully-Fisher. It's not a theoretical scale, it's a scale right off the Tully-Fisher relation, which is an empirical relation.
Absolutely. I agree. another reason to consider this is that nearly every talk in particle physics, including this one, begins with the following magical incantation. If I compute one of the correctness of Higgs mass, I find this is proportional to the Planck step. Right? And the argument goes that any new matter or cutoff that couples to the Higgs introduces a correction proportional to that scale. In particular, we know gravity exists, therefore, if gravity is a scale above Higgs mass, it introduces this correction. So this argument has one flaw, and that is we don't actually know whether the Planck mass is a scale. We have no identification of any particle that lives there. We don't know if it provides a cutoff field theory. Could it be a ratio of scales instead, G Fermi times some temperature? I don't think we know this at all. We don't have any direct probes of gravity at energies above approximately MeV. If you want to look at Higgs-Mann nucleosynthesis, you could plainly know gravity existed at MeV. Today, you know, solar system dynamics are probing gravity at very, very low scales. So,
but the nucleosynthesis, the gravity doesn't exist at all, it's temperature, and the gravity exists at the horizon scale at that time, right, which is much larger.
Well, you need cosmic expansion to be occurring.
You don't probe the gravitational force.
That's right.
The points separated by Earth.
That's right.
We probe
I'm not going to quantify exactly where we need gravity. although it's clear we needed it to very low scales, it's actually where, as I start to increase energies, I can turn it off and not affect anything phenomenologically is an interesting question I'm not going to answer. But clearly it's...
I think that's what Bergman knows.
But it's quite low.
No, that's right.
The point is it's quite low compared to the night scale. So the scale that I'm talking about here is actually a coupling constant. It is a self-interaction of gravity constant. As I was just saying, the scales at which gravity is tested include 1 eV from the CMB freeze-out, and possibly 1 MeV from the nucleosynthesis, if you believe in being aware of the 7-lithium problem, and okay, maybe even on this, and no scale above that. It would be completely compatible with direct tests of gravity if it actually turned off at some scale, well below the Planck scale. It's known that gravitational theories can emerge from field theory. There's these analog models and dumb holes, as well as Bolduc claims as a three-dimensional analog of gravity that lives within three helium. So at this point, I'm going to make a radical assumption.
So the turned-off argument, I mean, there's this whole argument against it by, I can't remember who, where the argument is that the, if you look at the lamp shift, you know, and the body energy of atoms, that since you're testing the equivalence principle of Bernstein 13,
it's a review talk.
And so I know that there's an issue. So how does this turn off gravity avoid that? Is it,
I'm sorry,
gravity, why do we not also turn off the lamp shift, say, contribution to the gravitational mass of the hydrogen atom? And then be ruled out by the test of the principle of equivalence.
In the lamp shift, you're measuring the gravitational contribution of the binding energy of hydrogen.
Right.
So this would be mediated in, I mean, you're sitting in a classical field, right? I'm sitting at the surface of the Earth. I'm using the surface of the Earth as a source for the atom. So in particle physics language, I'm exchanging the ladder diagram of soft gravitons, zero energy gravitons, between my atom and the Earth. So the energy of those gravitons is zero.
So the statement is not making turning off gravity. I guess it's all to do with what it means to turn it off. But
right.
if I draw a graph where I've got the momentum going around the loop, which is high,
yes,
that's not turned off.
That's not turned off. That's right.
As long as you're saying I have to hold gravity, it's the momentum in the graviton line that's important.
Yes,
turning off.
Exactly. Which shows up in loop diagrams, but not in any classical gravitational test. All classical gravitational orbits and planets, all of this, are very, very low energy. I mean, they're zero energy. In terms of particle physics, I would draw a ladder diagram of to compute the binding.
So essentially, you're invoking a form factor.
Yes, there will be a form factor for this gravity.
But that form factor, that's kind of why I asked it. That form factor isn't going to just turn off the electron-graviton vertex when momentum in the electron line is bigger than what you
say? It will, in fact, not turn it off. It will, however, if I go above the cutoff, I will now have an imaginary part to the form factor, because there's a dispersion due to the medium. If I have gravitons that are too high energy, relative to the cutoff.
Excuse me. About this, the statement about the gravity can be used from field theory. Fields as well, so we don't have any field theory which can let the gravity.
That's right. So Bolduc claims to have dynamical gravity in his three-dimensional theory. The statement about analog models is that you get curvature, but you don't get dynamics. You don't get a graviton in those things. So
Bolduc doesn't have diffeomorphism events.
No, it doesn't. So it is a three-dimensional.
By three, you mean 3 plus 1?
No, by three, I mean 3, 2 plus 1.
2 plus 1.
Well, not even 2 plus 1.
2 plus 1 have no gravity.
You have.
Anyway, if all you want to say is that there are some so far unrealized ideas,
yes,
that's
fine.
Okay.
Yeah. So far unrealized ideas. It's been tried. And it's hard, but so far it's been tried. So for this talk, I'm going to maybe clear about my assumptions. I'm assuming I live in a flat Lorentz invariant space, and this space contains a standard model, the flat standard model. There's no graviton here. There's no curvature. There's no background measure. Other than Minkowski. The reason to do this is because the existing models of gravity, namely string theory or loop quantum gravity, generally have the particle physics falls out of this accidentally. But this seems kind of backwards to me because we don't know very much about this series, and we do know a whole lot about the standard model. So I once asked, can the standard model, which I know all the parameters of, I know all the degrees of freedom of, can gravity actually fall out of it instead? So for this talk, there will be no curvature, there will be no different morphism invariants in this entire talk. I'll skip this slide since I already talked about this. So let me think about, just in very general terms, what's going on. So I have a relative neutrinos. Perhaps I should skip this and come back. So I have relative neutrinos, and this is going to end up being a theory of convect interactions in a quantum liquid at fine density and zero temperature. I'm going to explain exactly why this occurs in a few slides. The fundamental parameters in this theory are the Fermi momentum, again, this is just a proxy for density, and the Fermi constant. So if we examine an effective range expansion for the neutrino self-scattering, we can write the following. K times cotangent of the phase shift is 1 over A, where A is the scattering limit, plus 1 half K momentum squared times L0. So A is the scattering limit, it's the temperature times G Fermi approximately. That's the way it's scattering limit. And L is the range of the interaction. So in this expansion, I have the approximation regime that the scattering length is much, much smaller than the range. Now, this is a little bit strange. This is exactly the opposite approximation that one takes in atomic and nuclear physics. In atomic and nuclear physics, you can parameterize everything in terms of the scattering length. You can drop this term entirely. This gives you a very good description of the data. We're cautious to be careful when taking results from these fields, because generally one is dropping this term. This does tell us, however, that the dominant dynamics in this system is going to be proportional to this, which, first of all, momentum dependent, this is going to be P wave. I'm not going to have any S wave interactions. I can think about this in a different way. I can write down the matrix element for self scattering that has two pieces, the real part and the imaginary part. The real part, of course, just contains the W property. Yeah?
Can I say one?
Sure.
So you take A to be much, much less than L naught, so once you have some range of momentum which can have the S wave dominated and some wave of P wave dominated?
Yes. Very, very large momentum will be S wave dominated.
Very large momentum?
Yeah.
Well, I would expect...
This is a bad representation to see that.
Okay.
This is an expansion made by nuclear physicists when they want to justify saying that A is the only thing you need to worry about.
Okay.
Clearly, I want to take the limit A goes to zero, which right. is going to be a problem with this expression.
Yes.
So I need to be a bit more careful.
Okay.
So I will give you better results than that. So I can also expand the matrix element. I have a real part of this matrix element. This is simply W propagator deleting order, just 1 over N W squared, or just G Fermi. But the imaginary piece is G Fermi squared. That is, the imaginary part of the matrix element is related by the optical theorem to the total scattering cross section. And the total scattering cross section is G Fermi squared times energy squared. That is to say that the, if I repeat the last slide, this is to say that the range is much, much larger than the scattering length. That is to say that the real part of the matrix element is much, much more important dynamically than the scattering cross section. So, we should really ask, what is going on with this term? We drop it all because we always talk about, for dark matter and for neutrinos, we always talk about the scattering cross section. This is the smallest part of its interactions. So let me, that's the end of the introduction. Let me begin discussing what the neutrinos are doing today. So leading order is a very, very simple system. I just have a free Fermi gas. This Lagrangian is simply I have a kinetic term for my fermion, I have possibly a mass term, and I have a four-point interaction term that comes from integrating out the Z, which, for all the dynamics I'm going to consider, I can consider this to be a contact interaction. There's no Z propagating anywhere, it's always contact. So I'm going to ignore these interactions for a few slides and just look at what the kinetic term does. So the two-point function does two things. It gives rise, these two terms, give rise to the two-point function. This simply transports neutrinos around in space. The other thing that it does is it causes expansion of a neutrino's wave packet. If I assume that at some initial time neutrinos are localized, the kinetic term alone, in combination with the mass term, causes neutrinos to expand. So This effect is normally forgotten in quantum field theory under the assumption that we have localized asymptotic particles. The question is this a good assumption for cosmological relatives? It clearly works very well for atoms. So why do wave packets expand? They expand because they contain different wave numbers, and these wave numbers move at different velocities in the presence of any mass or an interaction. There's a wave number at p plus delta p, if I have some uncertainty momentum delta p, and this has a velocity of p plus delta p or b, while there's a wave number on the other side, which is velocity p minus delta p. And these, as this thing propagates, these things separate from each other. I can write the uncertainty of a wave packet, this is just the usual on mechanical delta x, and it's a function of time because of this effect. There's an initial localization, which presumably comes out of some initial creation or some hard scattering interaction that defines its localization at time equals zero. And then there's an expansion that is proportional to the velocity uncertainty. For the relativistic case, I have to use the following expression instead, because a relativistic wave packet doesn't expand. All the wave numbers move at the same velocity for a relativistic wave packet. So, assuming the uncertainty is given by the de Broglie wavelength, I have an initial time. I'm going to assume it's localized to 1 over its 3 momentum. And I can just take this to be the thermal wavelength. This allows us to derive a condition for a quantum liquid. So, at time equals 0, or equivalently, if I have no uncertainty momentum, I can get the following condition. That is to say, what I'm writing here is that I want the uncertainty to be larger than the interparticle spacing. This is the regime in which I'm going to have collective effects.
Are you going to be thinking that neutrinos are non-relativistic when we get to them? Or?
No, in fact, I want them to be relativistic.
Because that your wavelength there, the non-relativistic expression factor, 10 units. And so B is equal to square root of mg.
Yes. You can do it relativistically, it doesn't change.
There shouldn't have been an M in this, right? It just be 2VT or something.
That's right. Well, if the mass is zero, then there's no expansion at all, right? So this is only valid for non-relativistic. But that's the only regime in which I get expansion. Anyway, there's an expression on the next slide, maybe two slides, that is fully relativistically valid. So this is a picture of a wave packet. So I have some Gaussian localized wave packet, I have some difference in velocity, p minus delta p here, p plus delta p here, and these separate. So the condition for the quantum liquid that I'm using is that I want the uncertainty to be larger than the interparticle spacing. The opposite limit to this is a classical gas. This is the limit used by scattering theory when particles are localized. Delta x is less than this. If you open up Peskin and Schroeder and read about scattering theory, you find that this is to say that the uncertainty delta x will be smaller than the impact parameter b in terms of a scattering theory process. This temperature condition I wrote is only valid if scattering occurs sufficiently often that the time dependence can be neglected, where tau here is the mean time between collisions. So this holds for atomic and nuclear matter densities usually considered. In other words, atoms undergo hard scattering interactions often, whereas particles like neutrinos or dark matter pass straight through each other all the time and only very rarely undergo hard scattering interaction. I can make another assumption, that is that delta p is zero, which will cause everything to be very localized. I can make the assumption that delta p is zero, but this implies that delta x is infinity. I should have never done a word about localization in the first place. So, putting everything together and using time being the mean time between collisions, and this is valid relativistically, I get the following. So, if I can neglect the first term, which is valid for decoupled relics, I can come up with a criterion for the system to be a quantum liquid. And that is that the scattering cross section has to be less than 1 minus v squared over number density of 2/3. This is very, very well satisfied for both relic neutrinos and dark matter. Or just for numbers, the scattering cross section for these guys is about 10 to minus 56 in these units, or the number density is 10 to minus 8. So this means I'm going to have to worry about the dynamics, the collective dynamics, the condensed matter dynamics of these systems. We may have to worry about quantum nuclear dynamics for massless relics as well, because their temperature is related to their number density. And I can always take a system. I mean, imagine I take photons or massless neutrinos. I can always take that system and only look at the low momentum modes, which have a rotary wave length longer than each particle spacing. So I'll have to integrate out some modes, but that will leave me with half of the modes that I started with. So I'm still going to have to worry about this kind of dynamics for them too.
So
yeah.
For the free non-interacting fermion, that's always in the you can see how
free non-interacting fermion is always in the quantum region. Yes.
Even in high temperature?
It's independent of temperature. It has nothing to do with localization.
You know, there's a notion that at a very high temperature, you can distinguish fermion gas from boson gas because it's parity classical. So people say there's a company by stuff. Not sure.
So, okay, I'll show you how it becomes classical.
So that is that's kind of a free fermion, free boson gas picture.
Yeah.
So when the thermal wavelength is less than the interparticle separation, the company by stuff is here.
Well, what I mean is collective dynamics.
For non-interacting theory,
if a particle there's no collective dynamics. That's right.
And so because I thought, since you're looking for collective dynamics, you're probably looking for interacting system where you have more collective features.
Yes.
So I'm even surprised to see that. Your condition is satisfied better when you have a free particle.
Yes. Weird, huh?
So just the same question again would be, so you're comparing a length scale to the interparticle separation, and then what I'm getting from this is that the length scale you're comparing is not a measure of the interaction, it's not a mean free path, it's not a thermal wavelength, it's the scale.
Well, this expression contains only the mean free path and the cross section and the number density.
So your criterion for being quantum liquid is what is it that has to be for this? Large compared to the
delta S, the quantum mechanical wave packet size. And that's because if I pick a point in space, if I have a point operator and I integrate over all the external legs, and the position coordinate depends on all the external legs, if I have two wave packets overlapping, I have an expectation value for the operator. And this is what defines collective dynamics.
So you're saying if I took two free particles, the criterion basically that they can interfere with each other at some level.
Yes.
And that's what you're worried about more
yes.
than are they interacting?
Yes. More than if they're scattering, yes.
Mm-hmm. Typically, the size of a wave packet is thermal wavelengths, which decrease.
Well, typically, that is true because one is usually talking about atoms, which have undergone a hard scattering collision, an elastic scattering collision, very recently. So if I take a gas of atoms and I let them expand freely without collisions, they do expand like this. This is a known phenomenon. I mean, condensed matter physics have measured this before. So I know this is not familiar, probably to
this.
It's non-equilibrium, absolutely. Neutrinos are not in equilibrium today, neither is dark matter. That's right. If you were in equilibrium, equilibrium is saying I have scattering cross sections, or scattering events occur often enough to keep me close to the thermal wavelength.
And you don't have a coherence. I mean, if you're talking about light, you would have to worry about what the coherence length is. And you're not worried about that because you're saying if I turn all the directions off, nothing to equilibrium.
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, one might argue that there is an emergence of coherence.
That's not really the normal picture for neutrinos, right? So, would you be saying that neutrinos coming from the sun is they are coherent because they have
no, they're incoherent. I mean, first of all, their temperature is MeV, so it's very high, and they're totally uncorrelated with each other. And their wave packets expand very fast, but not fast enough to make solar neutrinos terribly interesting in this regard.
Your query, so the reason you don't think they're coherent is that you think that they just weren't produced in an overlapped way.
Yes. So I don't have the numbers in my head for solar neutrinos, but this expression here, if the initial localization is very, very localized, they will remain, they expand very slowly. if the initial localization is very wide, then this term quickly dominates. To put numbers in here, if I take relevant neutrinos and I localize them to the Dragoba wavelength right now, it would take approximately a picosecond before this condition that delta x is bigger than n to the minus 1 third was satisfied. Picosecond. So the question is then, how do we deal with this? What are the dynamics of this thing?
Before I let you go, I let you off the hook for this. So you'd be saying that solar neutrinos, I should never see interference with solar neutrinos going to the sun, because they're never coherent.
Yeah.
And so things like oscillations would be really hard to see because they...
Well, no, oscillation, I mean, two neutrinos, we don't ever detect two neutrinos, right? They can't interfere with each other.
But they are interfering in the sense that you're looking at a phase change.
Well, solar oscillation is dominated by the MSW effect, right? Which is the...
But that's the equivalent of two very small phase changes, right? There's the phase change of a small mass difference, and a very small phase change to a very small interaction with the medium. And then it's a generic regression through,
yes.
That's a big effect.
Yes.
But this phase change is different. And each neutrino kind of goes through and eventually doesn't interact with anything ever again. So
yes.
Nobody can interact with anything else.
That's right.
But by your criterion, you're saying that would be very interesting.
Well, so the presence or absence of collective dynamics doesn't necessarily have anything to do with mixing. I can still have mixing, and I can still have density waves.
I was going to translate what you're calling your quantum liquid thing into something to recognize. And I thought you were saying that coherence was what was important because you just have
opposite
overlap.
No, I'm not saying
that. It's not that, and it's not interactions. So what is it that is important?
Simply the wave packets overlap. But I have contact operators which have expectation values in the vacuum. This is not the same as requiring coherence. I mean, in the early universe, neutrinos were not produced coherently, right? It's the same as the center of the sun. There's a bunch of nuclear reactions going on, and they're emitted. And they're emitted from, you know, different nuclei. They're far separated in space. And so two neutrinos I observed at the same point today could have been produced at very different, separated points in space initially. And so their phases have nothing to do with each other. So they're not coherent, they're just overlap. So as I've been saying, this is when collective dynamics begin to become important.
Here you mentioned this kind of function you can also mention is a thermal distribution function. It's NP.
Yes.
I wonder. What does NP looks like? You know, for the ordinary NP is a Fermi Dirac distribution with some character at a certain temperature.
You mean N here?
No, NP, a line.
Ah, yes.
And what's your NP? That's a Fermi Dirac distribution.
I'm not sensitive to it.
But if that's a Fermi Dirac distribution?
So, yes, if it's a Fermi Dirac distribution in early times, if the universe is Hubble expanded, today you simply redshift the temperature.
I see. So what is temperature for that Fermi Dirac distribution?
Well, I mean, it's the temperature that frees out. It should be a QMEV, which is then redshifted to temperature today. So it's no longer in equilibrium. It's a tilted Fermi Dirac distribution. So this temperature is an ill-defined concept now, but I can't redshift the original temperature. And this is 1.9 Kelvin.
I see. So NP is not Fermi Dirac distribution.
I'm going to take it to be an arbitrary distribution where all of the wave numbers contained in NP are less than the Z-mass. That's what's really important here, is the wave numbers are less than the Z-mass. And I can allow NP to be whatever I want.
But one single character is also whether NP is close to 1 or close to 0.
Of course, yes.
In the Fermi liquid, you know, NP
is
close to 1, and that character is like kind of quantum effect. But NP is always a very close to 0, that's kind of classical gas.
So the point is the Fermi Dirac distribution, even if I assume it's far from the curve and has high temperature, if it was degenerate, it would come to 1. But even if it's completely non-degenerate, at 0 momentum, it's 1/2. So I always have a lot of wave numbers here at very long wavelength that can participate in collective dynamics.
But this is a zero mass picture.
No.
The thing that when I find the mass, the you know, at finite temperature, the even lowest energy will, you know, have some energy when the Fermi Dirac equation is obtained.
Yes. Sorry, what do you say?
I mean, because of neutrino mass, if neutrino can find the mass,
yes,
then the lowest energy neutrino can find the energy, and
yes,
then the thermal diffusion may be less than or half at the lower temperature. Since your temperature is
regardless of temperature, I always have this shape. And I go from, at low temperature, I go from a distribution that's like this, to higher temperature, I go from two distributions that's like this.
Oh, I see. So you'll say your Fermi, your chemical potential is kind of here.
No, the chemical potential is here.
Okay, yeah, it's not zero.
It's not zero, yes. Yes. Just as an aside, if you really want to kill dynamics like this, what you really need to do is kill the low wavelength modes. This requires construction of a thermal distribution function that looks like this. Right, kill the long wavelength modes. This is a very bizarre kind of thermal distribution function. I don't know how to create such a thing. You might be able to do it with an atomic gas, where you're scattering a lot, and this turns, but for something that started as a Fermi Dirac distribution, I'm not going to be able to all put a way to kill the low wavelength modes, especially because low wavelengths interact even less than other things.
So just on clarification, so when you say quantum liquid, it really means that NP can be close to 1. It's not always very small.
NP?
NP.
Yeah, of course, it is, and it is close to 1 for heat 0.
Some range.
Yeah.
Just, that's something that's important to understand. And the reason that it didn't go to 0 and wasn't Boltzmann suppressed was 1. Because your argument had to be small, I thought, was that the temperature is smaller than the mass.
It's very close to 0.
It's very close to 0. But you're saying that doesn't happen. That didn't actually work.
That potential is large.
It's not large, but it's not 0.
But compared to the mass.
If I take momentum less than mu, I find that this distribution is about 1/2.
Yeah, because mu is near, so mu and m and t are all the same size.
Yes. But even if they were not, there's still some mu. And mu defines, in particular, so what I'll get to is, mu defines the location of the infrared singularities in the loop diagrams. This is the Fermi surface. This is where I will see collected dynamics.
Well, if it was degenerate, I'd be happy with that one. So that's, but I see
it doesn't require degeneracy.
You're saying it's not so far from degenerate. So.
No. In terms of temperature and density, it's within factor 2. In fact, I have another paper on. So if I ask the question, if I have a beta decay which emits a neutrino, and this neutrino is zero momentum, I can ask the question, how much is it blocked by the presence of the background? Right? And if the background is very high temperature, it would be zero. The answer to that question is approximately 1/2. So in principle, this might be a way to detect the neutrino. It's very hard, but principle might work. So about a week before I said this, Fuller and Kishimoto published a paper in which they did this essentially the same calculation, and they find that if I just let delta x continue to expand, they find that the answer they get to this is the size, the delta x of a single neutrino is ordered gigaparsec today. I argue that this number is irrelevant once delta x is bigger than n to the minus delta x. This is where the dynamics changes. And if I keep going past that, I can't tell the difference anymore. Nothing else changes once the weight factor is bigger than n to the minus 1/3. Okay, so I think I've already said a lot of this. This all means the contact operators have expectation values. These contact operators define the collective degrees of freedom. For a Fermi liquid with repulsive interactions, which is what the neutrinos are, the collective excitation is called zero sound. This is the sound wave that's essentially driven by polyblock. It's non-collisional. Just as with the BBC, it's the or mesons, it's the attractive interactions that define the propagating mode of the system. There also is an index of refraction in the system. There is a forward scattering effect, which is important when there's no scattering. In other words, if I look through a plate of glass, this is a system that has no scattering. The leading order, the most important effect going on there is the index of refraction C's as it goes through the glass.
That's a very deceptive statement.
Why?
In the sense that people used to say that all the time for the MSW approximation in the sun.
Uh-huh.
And what's really going on in glass is that coherence length is actually set by the wavelength of the light is very long compared to the space in between the scatterings.
Yes.
And that's the thing that makes the forward direction so important. Although the interaction in amplitude wasn't so small because it's open again for something. Whereas for neutrinos, it's not in the moment because the wavelengths are normally very, very short because they're in the universe. And the scattering rates are not more close to space than that. So I just have to suggest on that particular. The plate across and now
okay.
People always use it.
Okay.
For neutrinos, not very good.
Okay.
Here I have another funny thing. You mentioned it's a repulsive march.
Yes.
You also mentioned there's a 56 neutrino per centimeter cube.
Yes.
What is the mean free path? Since we know that the
mean free path is much larger than the horizon size.
So there's no hydrodynamics. Because
no hydrodynamics.
Yeah, so there's a free neutrino.
Yes. So hydrodynamics requires that the system have time to equilibrate, which is defined by observables. This means I have to have mean time between collisions. The time on which I'm observing my system has to be long compared to the scattering time.
Exactly.
And scattering time is much, much larger than the age of the universe.
I see.
This is absolutely not hydrodynamic.
So then the zero sum, that zero sum is hydrodynamic
concept. Zero sum is not hydrodynamic concept, which is a very important point.
Okay. I thought every sound is hydrodynamic.
First sound is the first sound of occurring in hydrodynamic system. This was so named because the first sound was already known at the time that it came up. So I can give you some references on this. This was originally thought up in 1957 by Landau to describe the dynamics of free helium, which he realized required a relativistic degree of freedom. So in the context of his Landau-Fermi loop theory, he proved that there existed such a degree of freedom. You can find discussion of this in Landau-Lipschitz's book, Volume 9. This Landau-Fermi loop theory, Bain and Pfeffig had some discussion. The relativistic extension of this was provided by Bain and Chin in 1976. The best relativistic exposition of zero sound is in this paper by Chin in 1977. This is a paper about a theory called quantum counterdynamics. This is a theory of baryons with a meson, a vector meson, and a scalar meson interaction. I can map this directly onto the neutrinos because the Z is a vector meson for all I care, and the baryons are just neutrinos. In other words, the baryon number is equivalent to neutrino flavor number. One should be a little careful when looking at the Landau theory because it was only ever a phenomenological model. It's missing important effects. There's a fragment diagram that's missing from it, basically. You can find some discussion of this here.
The Landau theory lives off degeneracy, right? That was kind of why where the degeneracy effect came from.
Have degeneracy. What kind of degeneracy?
Your effective theory you're getting in the Landau cases is really limited. Nothing really happens because everything's probably blocked. Or something like that. That's why you have such weak interactions, even though the intrinsic interaction could have been stronger. And so then the pairing happens because you have these very feeble interactions like the phonon-phonon thing become important because all the nominally more important things like the plume interaction are being all locked away. And so but you're not going to use that same kind of mechanism because you're not really so completely blocked because you're not really degenerate in your distribution, right?
Yes. Well,
so the thing that makes it work for you, I guess, is that the neutrinos are just not interacting anyway, so that somehow you didn't even have to plug things away.
Yes. To leading order, I'm going to completely ignore Landau's Fermi loop theory, because it's wrong for this. Everything I have to do is the calculation based upon dimension. So all the finite diagrams are going to be there, and there's no funny business going on. There are a couple papers about this this problem with the Fermi loop theory in this respect. And as a consequence, I think a lot of the papers on Fermi loop theory, as they start to approach this regime, are probably wrong. So one must be careful.
Because here you mentioned that interaction is so weak, totally not. It's an example of a free Fermi system. Because
so far,
the universe is bigger than the universe, and the interaction time is longer than the age of the universe. So you can totally ignore interaction.
Well, totally. So what is the leading order interaction then? If I turn on interactions very slowly, very tiny interaction, what is the first term that I get beyond the free propagator?
But that's just say, but we know that we can estimate the interaction between neutrinos, but they are so weak, so that the mean free path of neutrinos.
The mean free path. The mean free path is exactly a statement of this. This is the mean free path. It's G Fermi squared. So when you say that the neutrinos are free particles, that's ignoring their index of refraction. So everything I'm going to be talking about is what is the index of refraction doing? Can the index of refraction define the collective dynamics? And that is in fact exactly what zero sum is.
This isn't like solar neutrinos in the sense that the MSW effect is the alpha GF effect. which is inside the sun, whereas the mean free path is much bigger than the sun.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. MSW effect is exactly in a refractive effect also. So here I'm going to take zero sound to mean any collective excitation with a linear dispersion relation. So the energy as a function of momentum is some sound velocity times time momentum as the momentum goes to zero. But another way, the degrees of freedom I'm going to describe are the density and the spin density fluctuations of the system. So neutrinos have repulsive self-interactions. This leads you into this theory. This paper is an attempt to find a superfluid in a neutrino system. And when basically the entire thing fails because there's a minus sign in the wrong place, neutrinos are repulsive. The true diagrams are all finite and repulsive and don't do anything terribly interesting. One is required to compute at one loop to see the infrared divergences of this theory. And of course, it's the infrared divergences that are going to define the collective degree of freedom. So in a Fermi liquid, this is a normal way of writing down the interactions. One has three diagrams. There's the BCS interaction, and there are two zero sound interactions. Here I've collapsed the Z boson interaction to a point. In each of the diagrams, so I'm working in the effect, the low energy effect of theory. There are two singular limits to this. There's the BCS limit, which is going to give you a superfluid, and there's the zero sound limit. In other words, these diagrams become singular in the forward scattering, or zero scattering angle. This is where this singularity occurs. And all three of these have singularities due to this fact limit. The Landau theory of Fermi liquid omits this diagram. And therefore doesn't have the exchange interaction. And that is what's going to be important for me. So for the vector mode, I can resum these divergences. So I get an IR divergence from these diagrams. This, of course, is the sign that I have a collective degree of freedom. I have a divergence and an operator. So I can resum the series by using Dyson's equation. So what this is a series of insertions into the vector boson propagator. So this is a Z boson with insertions of a neutrino anti-neutrino pair where both of these guys are living on the Fermi surface. So when I do this resummation, this is the full Dyson resum Z boson propagator in terms of its tree propagator, the polarization, the one part of the reducible polarization operator, and the full one again, this is Dyson's equation. So separating things out like this, I'm going to get a divergence here where the spectrum of excitations is going to be given where this coefficient here has a determinant equal to zero. In other words, there's a pole in the four-point, in the fermion's four-point function that comes from these diagrams. So I can write this thing as a dielectric function, and this, what I wrote in the previous slide, is simply a determinant. I can separate this into two pieces. There is a longitudinal piece, and there's two transverse pieces. This reflects the 3 degrees of freedom present in a massive gauge boson. There's one function for each. So these are the following. So the longitudinal one, it's 1 minus this one loop term, and phi is this function here. C0 in this expression is the velocity of sound in this system. Vf is the Fermi velocity, which is simply Fermi. This is also the Fermi energy. This will come up in future slides. So these are the expressions for the two. Over the 3 degrees of freedom here. So I can take the transverse mode, set equal to zero, and what one finds is that one has real solutions only if the energy of the collective degree of freedom is greater than the Z mass plus momentum plus this coefficient here. This is to say, for the two transverse modes, one only has an excitation for very, very high energies. This is called the Mason branch of the zero sound spectrum. For the longitudinal one, so let me take this and expand around C equals 1. So I want to know if there exists a relativistic degree of freedom in the system. So I can write this in the following way. This phi expanded out has is the following. And so I can, just looking at this expression here, this log, of course, is going to be singular in the limit that the Fermi energy goes to the Fermi momentum, or equivalently my mass goes to zero. I'm going to get a singularity here, which is going to cause this whole term to be zero. This gives me a relativistic degree of freedom. If I have phi m, I get a velocity that is quite small. So my velocity is now going to be this quantity here, which is roughly the density over mc. So for low densities, I get very small sound velocities for massive fields. This still approaches c as the Fermi momentum goes to infinity. This is the high density moment. So point is, the zero sound for a massless Fermi liquid is relativistic.
So what is the zero sound? I mean, is it what's awesome?
This is a density fluctuation. This is the vector motor, and it's a density fluctuation.
This is the longitudinal one specifically you're saying.
Yes.
And it's density of, I think it was density of conserved thing, is it Dirac number?
Yes, it is the you can think about this as the long wavelength oscillations around the chemical potential.
Chemical potential for electron here?
Yes.
And is this just then being driven by the energy potential?
Yes. What has happened here is, it's not degenerative pressure. The system is not degenerate. But inside each of these diagrams, there is a zero energy singularity when I can have the momentum, when I can place this on the Fermi surface. This is a polyblocking effect. My loop integral cannot have momenta running in it that are already occupied by the Fermi distribution.
Probably blocking rather than degenerative pressure.
Yes.
So if you did go to the degenerate limit so that it's something more familiar, what would this be in the Landau parallel theory? Some pairing effect.
No. I mean, nothing really changes. You just slightly enhance the coupling.
So this should be something that we should be able to recognize from parallel theory.
Yeah, I mean, it is an excitation of the Fermi liquid. It is the sound wave that exists in helium 3. This is just a relativistic generalization there.
Oh, that's what you're saying.
Yes, that's a new question.
Yeah.
Right.
So, this has a phase diagram as follows. Now, note this is for massive fermions. So, one has a branch here for low densities, in which one gets the zero sound. For high densities, we have these two branches that are that have a mass just above the z mass. And this, because I chose the mass to be non-zero, this doesn't show the massless branch.
And the speed is the speed of sound.
Speed is the speed of light. This is in contrast to hydrodynamic sound, which has a maximal speed of whatever the square root of 3 times speed of light. But because it's non-collisional, this can be relativistic.
So true, even if the neutrinos are massive.
Yes. Well, it's gapless if they're massive, but they have this velocity. This is quite a small number. This is,
I see. So it's 3 times 10 to the 6 in the massless case. And then if it's not, the neutrinos are massive, it's something which is can be very small depending on your diagonal.
Yes. So we can write an action for the collective excitations themselves. So the one loop operator is the following. It's got 4 powers of the coupling because it's got 2 vertices there. A loop factor, 1 over mz to the fourth from 2 contact operators. And it's chi dagger chi in terms of violet fermions, chi dagger chi. In other words, it is a particle-particle excitation, not a particle-particle excitation. It has momentum p here, which is, I put a twiddle over it for a reason. This is because it contains an index of a fraction. neutrinos themselves don't propagate, even if they're massless, don't propagate at the speed of light. Because the system contains a background of fermions here, and this induces an index of refraction. So the collective excitation also sees this index of refraction. This is important. So we can. This will let us define an operator, a mu. It's 1 over 2 times the fermion momentum. Chi for the coordinate x, derivative with respect to x, chi for y, and then the opposite.
So I think I can pretty well again, but so the coherence thing, I guess what bothers me about that is that normally for bosons, normally those are large n effects, right? You've got something non-interacting, and you're living off the fact that you've got a large number of things all in the same state. But these are fermions, so you can never have more than one in a given one state. So it seems
that doesn't mean I can't have wave function over whatever. 10 to the 10 at the same time. I can still have wave function overlap for as many fermions as I want for a given point in space. Poly blocking does not mean space like exclusion. They're similar, but I mean.
They're not in the same state, but the wave function overlaps.
I mean, if wave functions for fermions can never overlap, we can never have any interactions at all, right?
I guess I'm groping to see what the n is, that it's the large n that's controlling your mean field.
It's a number of particles.
So it's a number of particles, so somehow it's a number of particles in your delta x.
In some volume. I have some experiment, I'm just going to consume some volume.
Yeah.
And so it's a number of particles below that, and as was calculated by Fuller and Kishimoto, if these things are, if this gigaparsec number is right, I'm talking about all the neutrinos within a gigaparsec. I'm sitting on top of right here. So this is a very large one.
It seems to stress the way they affect us.
It
seems to stress that if I ding the neutrinos here, they're going to appear with the ones that are across the universe.
Well, if your wave function is that large.
Yeah. I mean, you're making a perturbation of the wave function, which is probably. So given this operator for the collective excitation, this mode is a Goldstone boson. So this theory is an expansion in a derivative over the fermion momentum. The effect of interaction is then the following, where I have a mu dagger. This is essentially a tachyonic mass term, right? For this field. And the minus sign came to come up because it was a chart. So okay, that everything I've described so far was a vector mode. Now the question is, the title had gravity in it, so is there a tensor mode?
Maybe it's a vector mode. Sorry.
Okay.
Whether this zero sum is a well defined mode or a sum mode within the particle continuum.
What do you mean?
In a Fermi gas, you have this particle continuum which you cover a finite region in a momentum omega space. And so if this zero sum dispersion relation lies within the particle continuum, that means this zero sum. Quantum can decay into a particle hole.
Yes, that's right. So
this is not well defined. Decay
yes.
Not well defined.
So
I try to see.
This, the statement that is a Goldstone boson is the statement that the expansion is well defined in the low momentum limit, where low momentum is defined by the Fermi momentum. So if I have oscillations that are, if you think of a crystal, right, I can have oscillations that are long wavelength with respect to the crystal space. These are stable modes, these are the phonons. And if you go to higher momentum, then I begin to see the structure of the crystal lattice. The same is here. There's no crystal, but it is still an expansion, a derivative of the Fermi momentum. So that is to say, this mode is exactly stable for momentum below Fermi momentum. For momentum above that, I can...
Not stable means they don't decay. The lifetime is infinite.
Lifetime is infinite, yes. This is a density fluctuation.
But whether this mode lies, okay, this velocity density fluctuation is the same, a smaller figure than Fermi velocity. Which here?
Smaller. It's stable when the velocity is, when the momentum is smaller than the Fermi momentum.
I mean the velocity of the zero sum.
The velocity is c.
So the same as the Fermi velocity right on the edge.
Yes. For a weakly interacting system, so if you put a mass in, the velocity would be the Fermi velocity times some index of refraction. So, to finish answering your question, for momenta above the Frohman momentum, I do get an imaginary piece. I can get back into a particle pair or a particle antiparticle pair. However, this interaction is proportional to mean free path. So the width of the state for momenta above the Fermi momentum is extremely small. It's longer than the lifetime of the universe. So, can we move on to tensor sound? So, in the last diagram, I resummed bubble insertions in the Gauge boson propagator. So this is not the full set of interactions for the four Fermi operator. In fact, it's not even Gauge invariant, right? So instead, what I want to do is resum the zero sound and zero sound prime graphs. Now, these are insertions of T and U channel exchanges of a neutrino pair bubble. So this is the following. This is simply a Fierce transformation of the previous operator. So the total operator, including both, looks like this. This EMU, which I'll define in the next slide, is the tensor excitation. And it is a particle antiparticle excitation, whereas the A is a chemical potential effect. It's a particle-particle excitation. So I write this in terms of the asymmetry eta. So this is the number that's 10 to the minus 10. So because of that, the particle-particle excitation is strongly suppressed relative to the particle-antiparticle excitation. So the dominant sound wave within neutrino background is actually a tensor mode. So these two modes are expressed as follows. I already wrote this one in the previous slide. The EMU, it's just a Fierce transformation, so it has a sigma matrix in it as well. Again, I'm writing about fermions here, because if I want the relativistic mode, it has to be massless, so there's no point considering the right-hand part of the state. Right, on the left-hand piece. So I have these two four-point interactions. They're the same interaction. And the derivative that appears here, again, contains an index of refraction. The velocity is not the speed of light, it's slightly less. I have these interaction terms, which again are Tapkin masters. Over time, I can speed ahead if people would like to finish, or I can go through some calculational details.
I would suggest seeing what comes, the rest of what comes next, and then going back to the calculation detail.
Okay.
It's not a time issue, but just see the big
picture. Sure. So I can go through and write out the essentially the way to calculate everything in terms of the Fermi propagator. This contains a distribution function which describes the polyblocking which essentially forbids modes between minus mu and mu given an antiparticle chemical potential and a particle chemical potential. Phrase chemical potential is not entirely accurate, but what I'm doing is polyblocking some modes here. As long as all of the modes involved are less than the Zmax, I don't care which ones they are. What I'm doing is I'm extracting a singular part of the integral by putting in the theta function directly. I can essentially take my distribution function and subtract off this theta function, which is a degenerate distribution, to isolate the singular pieces. And this leaves behind something which is integrable and has no singularities in it. So that's what I'm doing. I can talk about normalization if people want. I can talk about how to introduce into the action by the Hubbard-Chertanovich transformation or by the Legendre transformation, which is the non-equilibrium quantum field theory by Hermolt-Upkeep and Bolas, if you're familiar with this. I think there's a very beautiful way to understand this. This is close to the end here. We'll go three more slides. And that is that so the original action has a global particle number symmetry. This is just simply a constant phase rotation of my fields. This is broken by the condensation of this field. And this happened because I introduced a chemical potential into the theory. This AMU is the long wavelength fluctuations around the chemical potential. The order parameter here is the mu alpha. Right here. Mu being, so if I generalize my chemical potential to let it be a vector, and the rest frame this would be mu 0, 0, 0. This is the order parameter, and then the AMU is its long wavelength excitation. The EAMU is a neutrino antineutrino condensate, so it doesn't break the U1 number conservation. However, notice that this thing transforms as a bivector. It's got two indices, one of which is a gamma matrix, the other of which is a derivative. So
it was a sigma matrix in the last couple of slides.
Yeah, sigma. Sigma thermodynamic spinner, so it's
in SU2 left of SO31 spin.
Yes. So notice that the trace of this operator is simply the fermion's kinetic term. So if this E and U becomes a propagating degree of freedom, I'm going to have to make a shift to remove fermion's kinetic term to have a self-consistent theory. I can do that. So then I have a theory that looks like this. I have the original contact interaction, which is simply integrating up this E, and have these two tachyonic mass terms that appear. This theory has an enhanced symmetry. It is symmetric separately under the global SO31 space and the SO31 spin.
So where did you get the right-hand part of this?
It should be SU2 spin, right.
So it's SU2 left.
Yeah.
And the A is really a self-dual index. The A used to be a three-dimensional index, but it was three-dimensional index in SU2 left.
Yes.
Right, okay.
So there are possible breaking terms that might come from higher order calculations. These all have the form of having a sigma matrix contracted with a derivative, and these can be removed by leading order equations of motion. So at this point, let me add a Legrand multiplier to fix the charge under my two global symmetries. So as I said before, I'm going to add mu alpha, which is the generalization of the chemical potential. And the rest parameters, it's mu 0, 0, 0. And this is just the usual chemical potential. But let me also write down omega alpha beta times t alpha beta, where t is the stress tensor for a massless fermion. This I can rewrite in the following way. It's omega a alpha sigma bar a dk. What I'm doing here is I'm fixing the charge under global symmetry. Global symmetry being Lorentz symmetry. And of course, I'm always allowed to do this. The system had a plane wave background. So I'm describing expanding around this plane wave background in a self-consistent way. This EA mu, as a propagating degree of freedom, is the long wavelength excitation around this omega order parameter. So one can think about this in terms of breaking the SO31 process coming down to the diagonal. The index of fractions that emerges for the fermion is 1 minus another term that's proportional to the chemical potential, and another term that's proportional to this other order parameter. I can go into the Weinberg-Witten theorem. Do you want me to do that? Yeah. Okay, so Weinberg-Witten said in 1980 that most people believe you cannot get a condensate graviton of any kind. What their theorem actually says is that if I have a spin 2 massless particle in a flat Lorentz invariant space, it cannot couple to its own stress energy to a conserved stress energy tensor. Okay, so this theorem is absolutely true, right? There's no loopholes that I can find in it. However, people generally use it beyond its regime of applicability. People make the claim that composite gravitons will be without. So let's see exactly what this says. The theory with the background is not Lorentz invariant. In particular, has an index of refraction. This index of refraction is the leading order breaking of Lorentz invariants. One has an emergent Lorentz symmetry that is the same as the original Lorentz symmetry with an index of refraction plus some higher order terms. But the theory is not Lorentz invariant. The fundamental theory was, but the fermion momentum, or the chemical potential, or this omega, break it. And so one has the following objects which break Lorentz invariants. There's this expectation of E and U, which is the omega that we're going to do the slide, and it has a value today. This is the expectation of the stress tensor. It has a value that's minimized 3V. I have an index of refraction that is 1 minus something proportional to density. And in the flat space limit, in the limit that the Weinberg-Witten theorem is valid, all of these things go to the following things. The stress tensor, of course, becomes 0. The index of refraction, of course, becomes 1. The fermion momentum, of course, is 0. Newton's constant, which is the coefficient of this operator here. So I have several slides. This, you can get your calculator out and plug in the numbers here, and you'll find this is very, very close to Newton's constant. The Newton's constant is proportional to the density, and this goes to 0 in the limit of the Weinberg theorem is valid, and of course the Planck's constant goes to infinity. So, in other words, in the limit that I remove the matter from the theory, I also remove the condensate. And I return to the limit in which the Weinberg with the term is valid. I can write this in a different way. The Newton's constant is then proportional to the amount of breaking away from the flat space limit. So it must be proportional to 1 minus n. And in the end, it is proportional to 1 minus n over the Fermi moment. So therefore, this theory does have a conserved stress tensor for the gravitational sector. But it doesn't live in the same space as the matter itself. It lives in a flat space, while the emergent gravitational theory, the stress tensor doesn't live in the space of the sort of fraction. As string theorists would prefer to word it, the Weinberg-Witten theorem implies that space-time itself must be emergent. In the present context, this means that the space containing the graviton has an index of a fraction. And the graviton lives only in that space-time and not in the original flat space-time. There's another way to think of this that I think is very beautiful, and it is the operator that was generated in the end was momentum squared over n z to the fourth times some 4 Fermi operator. In a Lorentz invariant space, I have that this momentum is, of course, equal to vacuum Lorentz invariant momentum, and the index of a fraction is 1. This operator is then simply a running for my 4 Fermi operator. I could choose to absorb this correction by a choice of the finite part of my counterterm, the low energy effective theory. My low energy effective theory would have, the tree level G Fermi, and then I would have some quadratic one running. This operator runs quadratically anyway, so I can redefine it this way. So one can restate the Weinberg-Witten theorem as follows. In a Lorentz invariant theory, any emergent spin 2 degree of freedom could be absorbed by a choice of a normalization counterterm, and therefore cannot be dynamical. Or the way I like to state it is that gravity is the Lorentz breaking. I find I try to go that direction and I can't. Lorentz breaking pulls me in a different direction. So I'm now 15 minutes over time. I'll just go ahead to the end. You can ask me questions if you saw something enticing in the last few slides. So the universe contains a massless fermionic relic. If the universe contains a massless fermionic relic, which it certainly does, one option here would be, if you don't like this theory, would be to get rid of the neutrinos. This would be to say that you have to do quite serious violence to the theory of MEV temperatures, which is very well understood experimentally. If one has this kind of relic, then the long wavelength fluctuations around its vacuum stress tensor is a Goldstone graviton. If it has an asymmetry, then this is accompanied by a gravitationally coupled Goldstone vector boson. These are acoustic quasi-particles. They are Mandel zero sound, or you might call them phonons, although there's some language problem in using these words. This theory is entirely natural. The highest scale in the theory is mz. The cutoff is the Fermi momentum. This generates a natural cosmological constant. This is one of the things I skipped. This is essentially an implementation of Sundrum's soft graviton idea. The theory, I hope, maybe, may also contain keys to other problems in the next order in the expansion of these ratios and scales. This theory is supremely testable. We know how to make W's and Z's and neutrinos, we make beams of them, we can do all kinds of things. We're going to be able to prove this theory. If indeed it is true. So, that's it.
So maybe we have the same question, but if the theory predicts Lorentz invariant breaking and it's testable, what does it predict for leading order in Alpine for the photon propagator? That is, do you agree with the
photon propagator?
Why is photons would gravitate?
Because there is an operator connecting photons to neutrinos.
So Maxime and Rob would tell you that just in effective field theory, there should be, in a Lorentz breaking theory, there should be an effective term in the action of delta E cross B with 1 over M Planck in front of it. And do you predict that?
I don't know. So what are you saying? So
in effective field theory. So if am I actually using effective field theory as a Russian action? So if there's an asymmetry breaking in order 1 over M Planck, where M Planck is some combination of weak interaction coupling constants, then the leading order term is a dimension 5 term, which is delta E cross B.
Delta E is the...
No, electric and magnetic, this is Maxwell theory stuff, the electric and magnetic fields.
Okay,
with a 1 over M Planck in it. In front of it. So do you predict that this occurs as a dimension 5 term in the effective
field? No, CFT violin. No, all the dimension 5 terms is CFT violin.
No, it's parity island, it's not CPT violin. It is parity.
At one time I classified all of the dimension 5 operators for neutrinos.
No, this is maximum.
So, yes, so then all of the, for Fermi, all of the operators involving fermions, specifically the neutrinos, are CPT odd at dimension 5.
So you don't predict any dimension 5 breaking of the Lorentzian bands?
No.
Only dimension 6?
Yes. And keep in mind that this breaking Lorentzian bands would be there anyway, right? Because this background is there. Even if you assume gravity is something else, I must get breaking of Lorentz invariants at this order.
Okay, but not at this order.
I have a hard time thinking about this. Can you tell me what Fine diagram to draw? Is it that one?
Oh, could you close that one with another, put that one on its side and just close the neutrino loop so that you can cover the...
Yeah, so you want the...
There's a famous thing where the neutrino couples are 3 photons more strongly than 2 photons. There's a low energy result that happens if that 2 photon graph is suppressed by electron mass, whereas a 3 photon graph is not. So low energy is very not a process as just 2 photons.
But I don't know why. I still don't understand. Of course, you can write the interactions of different species with neutrinos. I don't understand why it falls to universal coupling.
I'm going to hedge on that question. I have reason to believe it does have a coupling. I have not fully proven it. One can use Weinberg's argument to say if one gets gravity as a low energy symmetry, you also get coupling.
Not necessarily. You have your Lorentz breaking right now.
So yes.
There's absolutely no reason.
What I think happens is that the leading order of the interaction of all these things are determined by the index of refraction. The index of refraction is always 1 minus couplings times the leading order breaking of an index of refraction would be here in the couplings because they're different group species, but leading order is 1.
Well, I'm trying to have some mechanistic understanding of how it's going, right? So you have some species, suppose it's completely from a different sector, it doesn't have a direct coupling from the neutrinos. Will it still have the same interaction?
Yes.
I don't know how it works on the thing. It has to flow somewhere. So you're saying that however small the interaction with neutrinos is, I mean, if it's 0, then it's 0, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not there. But if you put a however small interaction, it has to flow to some universal coupling.
That's
pretty remarkable if that happens.
Yeah. That's the conjecture. But you're not claiming that you know that it's true.
I'm not claiming that I know that it's true.
Did you predict neutrinos we produce on Earth at the most place in Ireland? Did you be predicting that they also have collective properties, that their speed is not speed of light in that moment? And then neutrinos?
Yes. I mean, they are.
How different from the speed of light would it be?
I don't know,
it's 22. No, it's not. So when you say it's falsifiable, what's the most falsifiable thing? What's the best?
That's the most tightly constrained thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. So, as I said in the beginning, I really wanted to get further on this before I talk about it again. In particular, I want to have a prediction for Newton's constant in terms of these parameters. I also have strong reason to believe neutrino mass may actually come out of this. So, it seems likely that one will be able to write down relationships among cosmological constant, Newton's constant, neutrino mass, and the parameters, the density, and of course the parameters we've already measured, like G and MC. One or more of these things may not work out. However, this leading order one can write down those relationships. And next leading order, there are new dynamics here in a principle one can test, because anyone see this vector boson? The statements I understand from my cosmologist friends is that it's the vector mode in Tevis which is responsible for the electrification curves. So I would like to know if that could possibly be.
No, that's not true. It's the other in Tevis which is responsible. Okay. The vector in Tevis just defines a frame and lets you then. Well, I'm not an expert about this, but lets you talk about lensing.
Okay.
Right. But I don't know that Tevis is something you want to aim for. That's another discussion.
Well, maybe not, but I mean, the vector mode does something. If there is an asymmetry, we should be able to measure by the vector mode rather than measuring 10 to the 10 relative neutrinos.
I would say the most direct thing is the universality of composition dependence of the gravity.
Well, if you take if this
neutron violations,
well, if you take a neutron and proton, right, they have completely different interactions with the neutrinos.
Yes.
Right. So if and the photon is numerically different, right? I mean, I'm not talking orders of magnitude different, but factor of a few, right? Factor of 100 between neutron and proton. By the way,
I can go into detail. More detail is how I think this works.
And if I take neutron and proton and separate them far enough, right, I don't usually need to resum the gravity between them. I can just take, single gravity exchange. You're going to be resumming that?
Yeah, you always have to resum.
What?
Which is, well, because it's a zero energy divergence.
I think what you're saying is that's the difference between nonlinear gravity and linearized gravity, right? That normally relies on the mass of large curve of Planck scale, which is not true for proton.
You want to know the force between proton and electron.
And I'm happy to consider a smooth scattering on the small angle, so I can just do one boom. I'm with you resuming the neutrino things and whatnot.
Let me do the appropriate resummation for this problem. That is, let me write photon propagating through the medium and only consider its contact interaction with the background.
Yeah.
This I must resum in the following way. Just as it has to do with neutrino. This gives me a four-point operator that is a proton, proton, neutrino, neutrino. Right. It has some coefficient that's Lorentz Weyl, so I have some g prime to the fourth. Okay, so it's the momentum in these bubbles that's going on the Fermi surface that's causing the zero energy divergence again. So the point is then, I cannot take a free proton. The free proton propagator must be resummed because it has divergences. So once I do this resummation, the propagator for the proton is now contained in this denominator here. Right? So this coefficient is going to go away if I rewrite this as a free degree of freedom in the background. This being the big violation of the equivalence principle that you're talking about.
Right.
What remains is the momentum operators that occur here, which all have an index of refraction.
So, you go away when you expand?
No, when I write a condensate, Q, whatever it is, I write this as a single firm, a single degree of freedom, say, Klein-Gordon equation. When I canonically normalize the field, I have a coefficient. coefficient, the constant coefficient term.
So you don't need them weak interaction. You can have arbitrarily weak interaction between machines and you'll be always flowing through the same.
Yes. So a dark sector, which is only connected to neutrinos by 5 loops, will still gravitate.
So controls your resummation. I mean, it's kind of it's a long sorted history of the beta self-heater rate and relativistic resummations, which more or less, you know, can be summarized by there's never a control of the approximations unless you were looking at non-relativistic systems where you have velocity expression and then you just feel sure rate. Yeah. What's the statement here that controls you when you're something like graphs to do? What's the small number that controls qubit laws and the runaway things that you go so?
That's a very good question.
I would say the following. You can look at this bubble insertion as exactly the same as drawing a T-channel photon graph. That's essentially the same singularity structure. So the kinematics of a usual ladder diagram of photons are essentially the same as this resolution. Mm-hmm. Because it's essentially this bubble which has the zero energy divergence. So I could draw other graphs that don't have bubbles in them. And you're asking whether they're important. That's a good question, John.
Because my intuition with zero energy divergences is that just like the block collecting thing, it means you really ask the wrong question, and if you calculate the right thing, it will diverge. And sometimes it's a resummation that fixes that, like if you have a lot of screening or something for electromagnetic, it could be thought of as a resummation, but it could be that the infrared physics that's relevant is a resummation, and it's going to be something else. It could be this black energy thing, it's a resolution issue.
That's an interesting question. There's another way to think about this that I prefer, and that is to use the two-part reducible formulas, in which once I have an operator, once I have a four-point operator like this, I can introduce an auxiliary field into the action. Now that introduction of the auxiliary field is equivalent to the Dyson resummation, and in that picture, I then get a kinetic term for that auxiliary field that we're looking at. This is much more well defined in my mind. To start from an action and just do manipulations in the action, and to go through the ugly non-relativistic path people went through to make the Schrödinger equation and all these things, which is difficult to relate back to the action.
You probably can find a situation where you don't have this.
If there's no divergence in your action.
No, you can't have a physical process with scattering.
If you've got a very hard scattering.
Is it really possible?
The point is, at each point along my path, I have contact interactions. And because, this is another way to say this is I'm doing self consistent field theory or mean field theory. I'm resumming interaction with the background. If you want to think about another way, this essentially is describing the wake, if you like, of the particle as it moves through the fluid. It's resumming all of the waves it makes as it moves through.
Very cool. So if everything works for you, you're saying that there are no quarks, and we suppose gravity is universal in this moment, so you're saying that. No particle is allowed to have strictly zero interaction with machines. But however infinitely small, it will always
flow. You can add something that has strictly zero coupling to everything. And that's rather boring theory.
But you'd also be predicting that gravity is very different than a supernova, say, when the interaction becomes really important.
Yes. There may be some interesting Tesla consequences in those kinds of systems. But it's not an argument on a slide I skipped. You can ask, when do I pull the thermals back, the neutrinos back to the thermal equilibrium? Right? And this occurs when the scattering cross-section is on shell for the Z. And this occurs at energy. So if you're thinking of supernova is MeV temperatures. So the energy of a probe has to be equal to mt squared over the Fermi limit. And this is of order in Planck today. So a supernova is not anywhere near high enough energy to actually hit the neutrinos. The neutrinos are still decoupled for all intents and purposes. The relative neutrinos are decoupled, and they do not
rough ones. The ones in the supernova ones are the third trap. So it's you're in a very different regime of potential as well, right?
Yeah.
You mean their self attractions might be collected?
Yeah, those would be the, well, that would be the important thing if that's not relevant.
Yeah, perhaps
that
would be interesting.
What about relic photons? Why don't, what do they do? They don't have this separating.
Have a slide like that. So that's a good question. I asked myself the same thing. So I started writing down ratios of scales, right? You might write down different ratios of scales. I can write down photons instead. Photons, the Ford Gamma vortex is dimension 8. Its self-interaction cross-section is approximately the following compared to the equivalent writing down the thing with the Fermi process. So it's smaller than neutrino self-interactions by approximately 10 to the minus 4.
This is dimension 8, basically.
Yeah. You have extra powers of the temperature over the electron mass. There are too many of them for it to be prevalent.
Part of the assumption of having relic neutrinos and photons, do you actually need gravity? I mean, maybe you said this, but do you even think about gravity to kind of trace back the cosmology to the point where
I am not thinking about cosmology at all.
So the assumption is that you have these relic neutrinos.
Yeah. I'm assuming I have these relics. I don't know where they came from, and I don't know what they're doing today. Cosmology is an interesting and important question, and I have not addressed it at all.
But you get your temperature by assuming you've got static gravity, right?
Yes. I'd assume the temperature today is of order the photon temperature.
So I guess it's
reasonable. But the calculation of neutrino temperature does require Hubble expansion. Right.
In your numerology, though, that when you were arguing that you're getting the Planck scales and particle physics scales, it's not quite fair if you then use the neutrino temperature as the Schrödinger physics scale, because that really came from gravity, and that was what, that's the same.
Oh, no, not necessarily. This gravitational effective theory is valid between the neutrino decoupling and now. So there may be something funny going on at decoupling. I would agree to that.
So it's almost immediate that you pick up gravity almost immediately after decoupling.
Yeah. Well, you could argue you can get it before decoupling, because what I really need to do is take the long wavelength modes of the neutrino background, which there will be some, right? And taking this Fermi-Dirac distribution. And what I'm saying is, if I go to higher and higher temperatures, okay, things are more and more localized, and so on. I'm only going to be looking at, you know, this portion of the thermal distribution rather than the whole thing. So I'm suppressing the collective dynamics, but I can't kill it entirely unless I would somehow kill the support in long wavelength modes.
So you're saying at higher temperatures these effects will be smaller?
Yes.
Even though in a lot of your formulas, those effects are more both of the powers of PF.
Yes.
Does PF not go up as the temperature goes up?
It does. So, well, smaller relative to the formulas I've shown. Yes.
I wonder whether your theory works for short-range full Fermi interaction.
Short-range full Fermi interaction?
Yeah, just like what you call contact. I mean, if you suppose the neutrino has a full Fermi interaction, whether you use this parameter.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying all I used, the only thing I used was a four Fermi interaction.
So then in the, you know, in the upper core, the atomic system, you can create Fermi system.
Yeah.
With the short range.
Yes. This is a very interesting question. I would really like to find a way to test this in atomic traps. If I make a Fermi gas in an atomic trap, this is the right regime of parameters to see an emergent gravity theory.
In that sense, whether there's any prediction.
Well, one can calculate the Newton's constant, one can calculate the velocity of the electron.
Measure?
I don't have one off the top of my head, but I certainly think one is possible.
Have you looked at forward time variation of GA constraints?
I thought a bit about it. So the Newton's constant that I would predict here is density dependent, right? So if density is evolving, this would seem to imply that the Newton's constant is getting much bigger in general universe. So I haven't looked at this in a lot of detail, but the statement everyone makes is that I cannot make small departures from G Newton, DDT G Newton equals zero, or I will run into a lot of constraints. This theory, however, has a very strong running of genus, and also has a strong running of the cosmological constraints. So I would like to do a project asking the question, if I let the Newton's constant vary the scale, and also the cosmological constant, where g Newton goes like e to the n, and the cosmological constant goes like e to the m, does there exist any other solution that's compatible with observation for any other combination of n and m besides zero?
Well, the guess, I think, would be no, because lambda is irrelevant to PVN, and that's where the strongest constraints, I think, in time variation g come from. I don't know that for sure. But yeah, if you're splitting lambda scales A to B and you're saying I have some dark energy model of W non minus 1, basically. And so then you have a whole bunch of other constraints around too. So it might be possible you could find a degenerate direction by looking at time variation of G as well. But I think BBN is going to be the strongest constraint we'll run into.
I agree.
So perhaps since we've gone well over, we can think about the